Crossroads is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In the face of a national housing shortage, Americans have had to be tremendously resourceful to put a roof over their heads. Middle-class couples with two incomes struggle to purchase houses that their parents could afford on one. Gentrification has caused rents to skyrocket in inner-city neighborhoods and continues to drive older and poorer residents away. And the construction of low-income housing is almost paralyzed. Today we'll look at the mass conversion of garages into houses in Los Angeles and at the sale of an old union apartment house for musicians in Chicago. Also, the enduring music of Puerto Rican folk singer Roy Brown, the publication of a quadrilingual newspaper in San Francisco, a trip to the Circo de Carlo, and more. As the flow of immigrants into Los Angeles has gone up and the number of cheap apartments has gone down, homeowners have started parking their cars on the street and turning their garages into rudimentary living spaces. An estimated 40,000 people are presently living in Los Angeles garages, often without a bathroom, kitchen, heat, or insulation of any kind. Most often, the residents are mothers with their children. In Los Angeles, Bill Gerdner has more.
Maria has four children. She lives in a big room that still has the wood walls and rusted springs of a two-car garage. It's neat and cheerful, with landscapes that she bought for $2 and refers to with pride as her impressionist art. Her fingers are short and thick, stained with wood dye. She puts cabinets into mobile homes, earning $800 a month while raising four children by herself.
Siempre prefiero una casa con yarda.
The only thing I would like is a small house with a yard that came from the government and that I could make payments on. That's all. No way I am asking for a check from the government so I can sit here nice and peaceful. No, I would rather work. That's my final decision. I will work and earn every dollar I get.
Maria is an illegal alien who is now applying for amnesty. She came from Mexico 8 years ago after crossing the border on foot and riding up to Los Angeles on top of four men in the trunk of a car. Maria's eyesight is failing and her back hurts frequently, but she refuses to leave work for a checkup because she needs every dollar. Maria is 33. William Baer, a professor of urban planning at the University of Southern California, has written extensively on the problems of housing and will begin a field study of the garage dwellers next month.
I think the homeless and these garage people, which I call the near homeless, is in part the reflection of a new kind of economy we're moving into in the United States, in which we're getting more extremes between wealth and poverty than we've been used to in the past. And in that respect, it resembles more international cities, where you have the very rich living almost side by side with the very poor.
Most of the garage conversions are taking place in Hispanic neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and the people living in garages are for the most part people from Mexico. Mary Lou Villar is a legal aid lawyer in the Hispanic barrio of East Los Angeles who provides counsel to tenants renting garages.
Low-income housing is a national problem that needs to be addressed. And as a consequence of that, when there's not low-income housing, they go to places like garages or basements or things. And as an alternative to that, they go to the streets. That's why, to the extent that we can, we assist these tenants to keep them, even if it's in this place that's not something that I would want to live with or anyone would choose to live in, it's an alternative to being on the street.
Another person working with the garage people is Francisco Flores, a former bantamweight fighter who went on to graduate from college with a degree in psychology. He points out that the low-paid immigrants are vital to the local economy.
Because Los Angeles needs a lot of low-income people to work. Like, for instance, here in Pacoima, a lot of the people here go to the West Valley, like to Northridge, Granite Hills, Encino, all those places, and work in restaurants or hotels and all that, and they make minimum wage. They make like $100, $130 a week, and how are they going to afford a $700, $800 apartment or house?
Back at USC, Professor Baer has found that little low-income housing is being built, nowhere near the amount needed to provide housing for 40,000 people living in garages. Private construction is geared towards people with middle or high incomes. Federal funds are dwindling, and local governments are strapped for money. Baer has found that as a result, almost all elected officials would rather avoid the vast human problem of the garage dwellers.
I've grown up in Los Angeles, born and raised in Los Angeles. And the semi-sleepy community that I knew when I was a teenager is no longer with us. This is an international, world-class city, and we're never going to go back to the sleepy San Fernando Valley of the 1950s. We are going to be more like New York, whether we like it or not. It's inevitable. And it's just a matter of getting people adjusted. And can we slow down growth enough so that it's a tolerable change for them versus an instant change, which they find intolerable?
Back in Pacoima, Maria is one of the newcomers. Her wishes for the future are simple.
Sí, me gustaría tener un poquito más de dinero.
Yes, I would like a little more money so I could live a little better. But if that can't be done, I accept that. Because I know very well that in many parts of the world, there are people that would consider this a palace.
For Crossroads, this is Bill Gerdner in Los Angeles.
Southeast Asians make up half of the population of the Tenderloin, one of San Francisco's poorest neighborhoods. To serve the area's changing character, the Tenderloin Times recently became the first paper in the nation to publish in four languages, three of them Southeast Asian. Joanne Marr paid a visit to the offices of the Times and has this report.
The Tenderloin Times is located on a noisy block in the heart of San Francisco. The office is surrounded by shabby buildings, porno shops, and X-rated movie houses. Inside, the Tenderloin Times is not much quieter. The crowded suite of offices overlooks a busy intersection. From the windows, you can see many people passing by. Mian village women, homeless people, senior citizens, young children of all races and nationalities. In its effort to serve such a diverse population, the Tenderloin Times went multilingual in 1985. Tenderloin Times editor Sarah Colm.
We were aware that as the Tenderloin changed, the newspaper needed to change with it. And since the late 70s and early 80s, there's been a massive influx of Southeast Asians into the neighborhood. And we were aware that there were many people in the neighborhood who could not read our newspaper. So we now have one page of Lao, one page of Cambodian, and then a two-page spread for Vietnamese.
Chatanom Unkeo is the Tenderloin Times Laotian reporter. She's reading one of her articles published recently in the Times. Chatanom and the other Southeast Asian reporters cover local stories of interest to their communities. Topics range from health care and housing issues to the plight of refugees in camps along the Thai-Cambodian border. For Times editor Sarah Colm, it's just as important to cover the people living in the neighborhood.
Some of the other coverage we've done of the Southeast Asian community has been around the culture of the different ethnic groups. So we might cover the opening of a new Buddhist temple or traditional dance performance or efforts to form a school for their language so the kids can learn their own native tongue.
After the articles are written, they are translated and also published in English. The paper is widely read in the Tenderloin community and has a circulation of 15,000. One person who has followed the Times for several years is Vu Duc Vong, executive director of a Southeast Asian refugee center in the Tenderloin. According to Vu, the non-Asian residents know little about their neighbors, and the paper educates the community by focusing attention on the refugees.
If you write about a refugee family, then that's a good way to let other people know, you know, these are real people, they have flesh and blood, they have feelings, they suffer, they cry, they laugh, they have joy, just like everyone else they are. And that is the main thing, is to get different people who don't know anything about one another to accept the fact that they may be look different, but deep down they're all people, just like you and me.
When they first arrived in the Tenderloin, the Southeast Asians were regarded with curiosity, suspicion, and even hostility. Many of the older residents saw them as a monolithic group. The Tenderloin Times has helped in bridging the gap among the diverse sectors of the population. Vu Duc Vong.
The refugees who live in the Tenderloin, probably next door to people who are not refugees, elderly couple, for instance, but they never come into contact with them, partly because of the language, partly because there's no interest in either side to make that first step to break the ice. And so they may live next door, but they don't understand what those people are like. Stories in the Tenderloin Times bring out that kind of aspect.
The Tenderloin Times also covers issues of importance to the community as a whole. Stories include the plight of the homeless, lack of heat in rundown hotels, and AIDS among poor people and minority groups. The newspaper survives on small foundation grants and is published monthly. It can be found in many stores, restaurants, and social service agencies. Times editor Sarah Colm says that the newspaper's limited budget poses problems not often encountered by the mainstream press.
At this point, unfortunately, the Tenderloin Times has limited space for the Southeast Asian section, and it actually takes more column inches to say the same thing in Cambodian than it does in English. So if you have one page of Cambodian, if that were written completely in English, it would be about half a page. So it's really very small amount of space that we have funding for at this time. We're trying to do something right now to change our front page format to make it more clear from just glancing at the paper that it's not just an English-only paper, but that inside the paper there are these different languages. And we also want to start putting the Vietnamese page, starting that on the back page of the paper so that it's more likely that you'll just come across the paper and know that it has your language in it.
The Tenderloin Times multilingual format reflects the neighborhood's changing character. The language barriers that have kept ethnic groups isolated from one another are gradually eroding. And the Tenderloin Times staff hopes it can continue to play a role in breaking down those barriers. Reporting in San Francisco for Crossroads, I'm Joanne Marr.
At one time or another, everyone dreams of joining the circus. Carlos Farfan didn't have to. He was born into it. Farfan is a sixth-generation member of the Flying Farfans, the renowned trapeze family which has performed with circuses throughout the world. As Nan Lieberman reports, Farfan has finally realized his childhood dream of owning his own circus, the Circo de Carlo.
Chilean-born Carlos Farfan knows the circus literally inside and out. He's built big tops all over the world and safety nets to catch those who don't fly through the air with the greatest of ease. He's performed for audiences as large as 20,000 in the Andes, as well as for the Pope in Italy. He produced the circus for the World's Fair in New Orleans, and following its six-month run, gathered his resources to open his own one-ring Circo di Carlo.
And I want to follow up a tradition from the typical European-style circus, which is the circus in Latin America. In Mexico, in South America, we have the circus with one ring. The people feel as they come home when they come to see a one-ring circus because they are familiar with. Now, the children that have grown in the United States, they are not aware. They have no knowledge of one-ring circus. Then they come with their parents and they love it. But also, the American children, they love my show.
Circo di Carlo is one of 30 small circuses in the U.S., and the only one which is performed as frequently in Spanish as it is in English. Their roster reads like an atlas of Central and South America. There are Peruvian acrobats, Mexican jugglers, Chilean clowns, Colombian high-wire artists, Brazilian tightrope walkers, and the list goes on and on. The weekly budget for this 36-member company is what a large circus spends to feed one elephant. Ringmaster Farfan introduces the acts in a sparkling white tuxedo. The rest of the troupe wear colorful sequin costumes like the performers in bigger, better-known circuses. But there's something really special about Circo di Carlo. They travel the back roads as well as the freeways to perform in the low-income and working-class Latin neighborhoods passed over by larger, more expensive three-ring circuses.
It is not come and get it and go. We want to be proudly part of the community, which is very hard to make the community believe that because they look this as a business. But this is our life. Every single engagement that we do with our circus, we do always a benefit. In our own little way, we try to help the community. We try to be part of, which is important for us, because then in the future they look forward for us. This truly is not my business. This is my life. Being my life, I have to be very careful. I select my performers, I select my families, I select my people, my workers, and I select the quality of the show.
You better watch it. Yo respondo.
There are some other unusual things about this circus. First, there are no animals. No tigers, no lions, and no elephants. And the same daring young man who had you holding your breath while he did somersaults and rode his unicycle across the tightrope sells soft drinks during intermission. The pretty lady who dangled by one ankle on the trapeze scoops out buttery palomitas, or popcorn. And the kids find special delight in touching the glittery costumes and talking to their circus idols. For Carlos's wife, Teresa, it's all part of la magia del circo.
The circus is circus. It's a pink elephant. It's a pink magic. All, everybody think it's circus life, they think it's the same way. It's a magic, it's a life, and you care about what the claps of the people, you care that you do the best for them. It's a magic, a circus is a magic.
Hey, Sega!
What happened?
Three snow cones and one Diet Coke.
Snow cone is right. One Coke?
Diet Coke.
For Crossroads, this is Nan Sherry Lieberman in Los Angeles.
Drexel Avenue is rather typical for the south side of Chicago. A few single-family homes are scattered up and down the street, but mostly this is a neighborhood of solid brick apartment buildings. Peeling paint and the occasional boarded window belie the neighborhood's competitive rents. Those are blamed on the nearby University of Chicago. At 5320 South Drexel, residents have been enjoying an umbrella of protection from rising rents. They are nearly all musicians living in a building bought by their own Chicago Federation of Musicians in 1952. But the union is selling to a private owner this month, and it's spreading shock and confusion throughout this artist haven. Marge Halperin reports.
The musicians' building's creaky stairs and fading paint signal a comfortable home for those union members lucky enough to get one of the 31 apartments here. Some have been here since the union bought the building 35 years ago. Others just recently landed an apartment. There's a unique security here that comes from living in a place where neighbors are both friends and co-workers who understand the quirks of an artist's lifestyle.
When I come back at 4 o'clock in the morning, I feel safe. There's always somebody, there's always a light on somewhere. Very often we meet any other musicians who are coming back. Are you playing tonight? Where were you? It's very different than if you live in another kind of building. I used to live on the north side before, and one day I just laid my dolly for my amp outside. For 5 minutes, it was gone. Here, I could leave my bass. Nobody in the building would touch it. As a matter of fact, they take it in the house to make sure that it's safe.
Bassist Cecile Savage moved here from France in 1972 to join the local blues scene. After 5 years in the musician's building, she's starting to pursue the want ads as she watches new crews paint, carpet, and rehab the rundown old apartments.
I've been asking the janitor yesterday. He said, oh, no, they won't make him. We don't know. They may tell us we can't stay, but raise the rent to $500. That's about the same to me as having to move.
Across the building's grassy courtyard, bassist Eddie Calhoun doodles on his electric piano while Billie Holiday watches from a dark painting on his living room wall. Calhoun is moving next month into another sought-after apartment, this one in a senior citizens building with subsidized rent. It's a stable home, but Calhoun will miss the musicians' community.
The guy live above me play piano. The guy live downstairs play saxophone. Across the court, there's two singers. Singer down there, so just the fact that you can hear other musicians practicing, it's inspiring.
Most of the building's residents are black, but the all-black union local that originally bought the building long ago merged with a larger white local. Many residents hint racism, or at least racial indifference, is at the root of the building's sale. The union says the sale was strictly an economic move. Membership has been cut almost in half over the past 20 years, now standing at just 8,000. The union lost $300,000 last year and has decided to get out of the real estate business. It's even selling its own downtown headquarters. What's next for the Musicians Building? The new owner is unavailable for comment, and lifelong tenants have learned to be suspicious of a landlord's promises anyway. At best, a change in management will mean some badly needed improvements, with affordable rents to encourage the musicians to stay. At worst, gentrification will make good money for the landlord, and the musicians, traditionally a migrant lot, will scatter to new homes. Cecile Savage says they won't be the first victims of the yuppifying of Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood.
Hyde Park used to be a highly artistic neighborhood, which it is not anymore because the people in Hyde Park are very conservative and they want to keep the neighborhood with people who have money. Artists bring a totally different kind of vibes. Usually they don't have a lot of money, but they have advanced ideas. They don't usually live like other people. And when they are black, and if even white, actually, I think the great artists have always been some kind of revolutionary in their minds. So people don't want that in their neighborhood. So in Hyde Park, there used to be a lot of clubs in Hyde Park. There used to be the Beehive, Charlie Parker would come play here. Now they have no clubs, strangely enough. You can't go hang out nowhere in Hyde Park.
For her part, Savage plans to rent on the city's north side, which in recent years has become home to an increasing number of new blues and jazz clubs, a revitalized music scene that seems to be picking up where the south side blues tradition left off. For Crossroads, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Few styles have had as much impact on the Latin American music scene as the Nueva Canción, or New Song, movement. Since its origins in the 60s, it has evolved from being a rather raw and direct protest music to a sophisticated and rich international music form. Puerto Rican composer and singer Roy Brown, one of the most famous Latin New Song performers, has just released an album he recorded in Cuba. Elizabeth Perez Luna reports.
I would say the perfect album is an album that is a commentary on life in general, and it will include love and it will include politics.
Roy Brown's new album, Árboles, Trees, fits his description, and it's the result of his collaboration with Cuban singer and composer Silvio Rodriguez, one of the creators of the new Latin American song style.
Song has many purposes. First of all, it's like it's entertaining. It satisfies your brain, a necessity that we have in our minds to do a tune, to reproduce a tune, to soar with a tune. It's a very emotional thing. But also, words are put together in such a way that creates a feeling of well-being, of control, of understanding things. And you just to say those words, and it creates such an incredible pleasure that it's one of the most important art forms that we have.
20 years ago, the Nueva Canción developed in Chile, Argentina, Cuba, and Puerto Rico out of a need for young musicians to express their political concerns within the context of Latin America's reality. Since then, it has continued to evolve in many directions, often losing some of the sense of urgency that the times demanded, but always retaining its commitment to content. Esta noche tuve que salir a correr, sentir el viento y sudar, cual fuma la roca. Roy Brown started singing in Puerto Rico in the early 60s. His songs spoke of rebellion, injustice, and the need to change society. But even then, he used his poetry and that of other Puerto Rican poets to express the complexities of modern times.
You can't say that all art reflects or comments on society. Some painting is just a commentary on the potential of color. And some songs are just a commentary on the potential of sound.
para cuando la emoción se acerque a su cuadrado, tu imaginación cautive la palabra con labios. Esos árboles le dan albergue a la opinión desamparada que tan elocuentemente cultiva la anonimia, donde la madera verde de la lluvia le brota en llamaradas por los dedos.
Brown moved to New York in 1976 and has been performing throughout the United States and Latin America for more than 15 years, mostly in concerts that are dedicated to solidarity movements and political action.
Well, at the beginning, I mean, we were just barricade singers. And people came because of the political content. So let's say if I would do one song that was very political, great, that's where they clap. But if I do a song about the relationship between a man and a woman, about love, about the love of nature, they would say, oh, you know, what a boring concert. Well, because all they wanted was, hey, 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 hey. And then they only wanted to pay $2 for that, you know. And then they would go to this other concert where they had received this big sound of music with no content at all, and they would pay $20 for that, and they'd have a blast, you know? So we're changing people's tastes for music, art.
Desde las ondas del mar, que son besos a su orilla, una mujer de Aguadilla vino a New York a cantar. Pero no solo a llorar, un largo llanto y morir, de ese llanto yo nací.
In Árboles, his 10th album, Roy Brown, Silvio Rodríguez, and the group Afro Cuba combine Latin American tunes, jazz, pop, and Caribbean rhythms. The album, recorded in Cuba and manufactured in New York, works within the new style of the Nueva Canción, where exploring music as a language seems to be as important as the content of the songs. And the songs speak of love, hardship, injustice, fun, friendship, and just plain living. For Crossroads, this is Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Crossroads, an Earmark production, is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna. Producer Charles Hardy. Engineered by Len Persky at Toucan Productions in Philadelphia. Theme music composed by Jack Landrone and arranged by Jack Jeffers. We welcome your comments and ideas. You can reach us at Crossroads, Box 1685, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19105. For Crossroads, I'm Anthony Wilson. In the second part of this Crossroads feed, 5 modules with recorded suggested host intros. But first, here's Crossroads theme music you can use for your own promos. Here are this week's Crossroads modules. As the flow of immigrants into Los Angeles has gone up and the number of cheap apartments has gone down, homeowners have started parking their cars on the street and turning their garages into rudimentary living spaces. An estimated 40,000 people are presently living in Los Angeles garages, often without a bathroom, kitchen, heat, or insulation of any kind. Most often the residents are mothers with their children. In Los Angeles, Bill Gerdner has more. 3, 2...
Maria has 4 children. She lives in a big room that still has the wood walls and rusted springs of a two-car garage. It's neat and cheerful with landscapes that she bought for $2 and refers to with pride as her impressionist art. Her fingers are short and thick, stained with wood dye. She puts cabinets into mobile homes, earning $800 a month while raising 4 children by herself.
Siempre prefiero una casa con yarda.
The only thing I would like is a small house with a yard that came from the government and that I could make payments on. That's all. No way I am asking for a check from the government so I can sit here nice and peaceful. No, I would rather work. That's my final decision. I will work and earn every dollar I get.
Maria is an illegal alien who is now applying for amnesty. She came from Mexico 8 years ago after crossing the border on foot and riding up to Los Angeles on top of 4 men in the trunk of a car. Maria's eyesight is failing and her back hurts frequently, but she refuses to leave work for a checkup because she needs every dollar. Maria is 33. William Baer, a professor of urban planning at the University of Southern California, has written extensively on the problems of housing and will begin a field study of the garage dwellers next month.
I think the homeless and these garage people, which I call the near homeless, is in part the reflection of a new kind of economy we're moving into in the United States, in which we're getting more extremes between wealth and poverty than we've been used to in the past. And in that respect, it resembles more international cities, where you have the very rich living almost side by side with the very poor.
Most of the garage conversions are taking place in Hispanic neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and the people living in garages are for the most part people from Mexico. Mary Lou Villar is a legal aid lawyer in the Hispanic barrio of East Los Angeles who provides counsel to tenants renting garages.
Low-income housing is a national problem that needs to be addressed, and as a consequence of that, when there's not low-income housing, they go to places like garages or basements or things, and as an alternative to that, they go to the streets. That's why, to the extent that we assist these tenants to keep them, even if it's in this place that's not something that I would want to live with or anyone would choose to live in, it's an alternative to being on the street.
Another person working with the garage people is Francisco Flores, a former bantamweight fighter who went on to graduate from college with a degree in psychology. He points out the low-paid immigrants are vital to the local economy.
Because Los Angeles needs a lot of low-income people to work. Like, for instance, here in Pacoima, a lot of the people here go to the West Valley, like to Northridge, Granite Hills, Encino, all those places, and work in restaurants or hotels and all that, and they make minimum wage. They make like $100, $130 a week, and how are they going to afford a $700, $800 apartment or house?
Back at USC, Professor Baer has found that little low-income housing is being built, nowhere near the amount needed to provide housing for 40,000 people living in garages. Private construction is geared towards people with middle or high incomes. Federal government is dwindling, and local governments are strapped for money. Baer has found that as a result, almost all elected officials would rather avoid the vast human problem of the garage dwellers.
I've grown up in Los Angeles, born and raised in Los Angeles, and the semi-sleepy community that I knew when I was a teenager is no longer with us. This is an international, world-class city, and we're never going to go back to the sleepy San Fernando Valley of the 1950s. We are going to be more like New York, whether we like it or not. It's inevitable. And it's just a matter of getting people adjusted, and can we slow down growth enough so that it's a tolerable change for them versus an instant change, which they find intolerable.
Back in Pacoima, Maria is one of the newcomers. Her wishes for the future are simple.
Yes, I would like a little more money so I could live a little better. But if that can't be done, I accept that. Because I know very well that in many parts of the world, there are people that would consider this a palace.
In Los Angeles, this is Bill Gertner.
Southeast Asians make up half of the population of the Tenderloin, one of San Francisco's poorest neighborhoods. To serve the area's changing character, the Tenderloin Times recently became the first paper in the nation to publish in 4 languages, 3 of them Southeast Asian. Joanne Marr paid a visit to the offices of the Times and has this report. 3, 2.
The Tenderloin Times is located on a noisy block in the heart of San Francisco. The office is surrounded by shabby buildings, porno shops, and X-rated movie houses. Inside, the Tenderloin Times is not much quieter. The crowded suite of offices overlooks a busy intersection. From the windows, you can see many people passing by. Mien village women, homeless people, senior citizens, young children of all races and nationalities. In its effort to serve such a diverse population, the Tenderloin Times went multilingual in 1985. Tenderloin Times editor Sarah Colm.
We were aware that as the Tenderloin changed, the newspaper needed to change with it. And since the late 70s and early 80s, there's been a massive influx of Southeast Asians into the neighborhood. And we were aware that there were many people in the neighborhood who could not read our newspaper. So we now have one page of Lao, one page of Cambodian, and then a two-page spread for Vietnamese.
Chatanom Unkeo is the Tenderloin Times Laotian reporter. She's reading one of her articles published recently in the Times. Chatanom and the other Southeast Asian reporters cover local stories of interest to their communities. Topics range from healthcare and housing issues to the plight of refugees in camps along the Thai-Cambodian border. For Times editor Sarah Colm, it's just as important to cover the people living in the neighborhood.
Some of the other coverage we've done of the Southeast Asian community has been around the culture of the different ethnic groups. So we might cover the opening of a new Buddhist temple or traditional dance performance or efforts to form a school for their language so the kids can learn their own native tongue.
After the articles are written, they are translated and also published in English. The paper is widely read in the Tenderloin community and has a circulation of 15,000. One person who has followed the Times for several years is Vu Duc Vong, executive director of a Southeast Asian refugee center in the Tenderloin. According to Vu, the non-Asian residents know little about their neighbors, and the paper educates the community by focusing attention on the refugees.
If you write about a refugee family, then that's a good way to let other people know, you know, these are real people. They have flesh and blood. They have feelings. They suffer. They cry. They laugh. They have joy just like everyone else. They are. And that is the main thing, is to get different people who don't know anything about one another to accept the fact that they may be look different, but deep down they're all people just like you and me.
When they first arrived in the Tenderloin, the Southeast Asians were regarded with curiosity, suspicion, and even hostility. Many of the older residents saw them as a monolithic group. The Tenderloin Times has helped in bridging the gap among the diverse sectors of the population. Vu Duc Vong.
The refugees who live in the Tenderloin, probably next door to people who are not refugees, elderly couple, for instance, but they never come into contact with them, partly because of the language, partly because there's no interest in either side to make that first step to break the ice. And so they may live next door, but they don't understand what those people are like. Stories in the Tenderloin Times bring out that kind of aspect.
The Tenderloin Times also covers issues of importance to the community as a whole. Stories include the plight of the homeless, lack of heat in rundown hotels, and AIDS among poor people and minority groups. The newspaper survives on small foundation grants and is published monthly. It can be found in many stores, restaurants, and social service agencies. Times editor Sarah Colm says that the newspaper's limited budget poses problems not often encountered by the mainstream press.
At this point, unfortunately, the Tenderloin Times has limited space for the Southeast Asian section, and it actually takes more column inches to say the same thing in Cambodian than it does in English. So if you have one page of Cambodian, if that were written completely in English, it would be about half a page. So it's really very small amount of space that we have funding for at this time. We're trying to do something right now to change our front page format to make it more clear from just glancing at the paper that it's not just an English-only paper, but that inside the paper there are these different languages. And we also want to start putting the Vietnamese page, starting that on the back page of the paper so that it's more likely that you'll just come across the paper and know that it has your language in it.
The Tenderloin Times multilingual format reflects the neighborhood's changing character. The language barriers that have kept ethnic groups isolated from one another are gradually eroding. And the Tenderloin Times staff hopes it can continue to play a role in breaking down those barriers. In San Francisco, I'm Joanne Marr.
At one time or another, everyone dreams of joining the circus. Carlos Farfan didn't have to. He was born into it. Farfan is a sixth-generation member of the Flying Farfans, the renowned trapeze family which has performed with circuses throughout the world. As Nan Lieberman reports, Farfan has finally realized his childhood dream of owning his own circus, the Circo de Carlo. 3, 2...
Chilean-born Carlos Farfan knows the circus, literally inside and out. He's built big tops all over the world and safety nets to catch those who don't fly through the air with the greatest of ease. He's performed for audiences as large as 20,000 in the Andes, as well as for the Pope in Italy. He produced the circus for the World's Fair in New Orleans, and following its six-month run, gathered his resources to open his own one-ring Circo di Carlo.
And I want to follow up a tradition from the typical European-style circus, which is the circus in Latin America. In Mexico and South America, we have the circus with one ring. The people feel as they come home when they come to see a one-ring circus, because they are familiar with. Now the children that have grown in the United States, they are not aware. They have no knowledge of one-ring circus. Then they come with their parents and they love it. But also the American children, they love my show.
Ladies and gentlemen, our hit show will start in just 5 minutes.
Circo di Carlo is one of 30 small circuses in the U.S., and the only one which is performed as frequently in Spanish as it is in English. Their roster reads like an atlas of Central and South America. There are Peruvian acrobats, Mexican jugglers, Chilean clowns, Colombian high-wire artists, Brazilian tightrope walkers, and the list goes on and on. The weekly budget for this 36-member company is what a large circus spends to feed one elephant. Ringmaster Farfan introduces the acts in a sparkling white tuxedo. The rest of the troupe wear colorful sequin costumes like the performers in bigger, better-known circuses. But there's something really special about Circo di Carlo. They travel the back roads as well as the freeways to perform in the low-income and working-class Latin neighborhoods passed over by larger, more expensive three-ring circuses.
It is not come and get it and go. We want to be proudly part of the community, which is very hard to make the community believe that, because they look this as a business. But this is our life. Every single engagement that we do with our circus, we do always a benefit. In our own little way, we try to help the community. We try to be part of, which is important for us, because then in the future they look forward for us. This truly is not my business. This is my life. Being my life, I have to be very careful. I select my performers, I select my families, I select my people, my workers, and I select the quality of the show.
You better watch it. Yo respondo.
There are some other unusual things about this circus. First, there are no animals. No tigers, no lions, and no elephants. And the same daring young man who had you holding your breath while he did somersaults and rode his unicycle across the tightrope sells soft drinks during intermission. The pretty lady who dangled by one ankle on the trapeze scoops out buttery palomitas, or popcorn. And the kids find special delight in touching the glittery costumes and talking to their circus idols. For Carlos's wife, Teresa, it's all part of la magia del circo.
The circus is a circus. It's a pink elephant. It's a pink magic. All everybody think it's circus life, they think it's the same way. It's a magic. It's a life. And you care about what the claps of the people. You care that you do the best for them. It's a magic. A circus is a magic.
Hey, Stegan! What happened?
This is Nan Sherry Lieberman in Los Angeles.
Drexel Avenue is rather typical for the south side of Chicago. A few single-family homes are scattered up and down the street, But mostly, this is a neighborhood of solid brick apartment buildings. Peeling paint and the occasional boarded window belie the neighborhood's competitive rents. Those are blamed on the nearby University of Chicago. At 5320 South Drexel, residents have been enjoying an umbrella of protection from rising rents. They're nearly all musicians living in a building bought by their own Chicago Federation of Musicians in 1952. But the union is selling to a private owner this month, and it's spreading shock and confusion throughout this artist haven. Marge Halperin reports. 3, 2.
The musicians' buildings, creaky stairs, and fading paint signal a comfortable home for those union members lucky enough to get one of the 31 apartments here. Some have been here since the union bought the building 35 years ago. Others just recently landed an apartment. There's a unique security here that comes from living in a place where neighbors are both friends and co-workers who understand the quirks of an artist's lifestyle.
When I come back at 4 o'clock in the morning, I feel safe. There's always somebody, there's always a light on somewhere. Very often we meet any other musicians who are coming back. Are you playing tonight? Where were you? It's very different than if you live in another kind of building. I used to live on the north side before, and one day I just laid my dolly for my amp outside. For 5 minutes, it was gone. Here, I could leave my bass. Nobody in the building would touch it. As a matter of fact, they'd take it in the house to make sure that it's safe.
Bassist Cecile Savage moved here from France in 1972 to join the local blues scene. After 5 years in the musicians' building, she's starting to pursue the want ads as she watches new crews paint, carpet, and rehab the rundown old apartments.
I've been asking the janitor yesterday. He said, oh, no, they won't make you. We don't know. They may tell us we can't stay, but raise the rent to $500. That's about the same to me as having to move.
Across the building's grassy courtyard, bassist Eddie Calhoun doodles on his electric piano while Billie Holiday watches from a dark painting on his living room wall. Calhoun is moving next month into another sought-after apartment, this one in a senior citizens building with subsidized rent. It's a stable home, but Calhoun will miss the musicians' community.
The guy who lived above me played piano. The guy who lived downstairs played saxophone. Across the court, there's two singers. A singer down there, so just the fact that you can hear other musicians practicing, it's inspiring.
Most of the building's residents are black, but the all-black union local that originally bought the building long ago merged with a larger white local. Many residents hint racism, or at least racial indifference, is at the root of the building's sale. The union says the sale was strictly an economic move. Membership has been cut almost in half over the past 20 years, now standing at just 8,000. The union lost $300,000 last year and has decided to get out of the real estate business. It's even selling its own downtown headquarters. What's next for the musicians' building? The new owner is unavailable for comment, and lifelong tenants have learned to be suspicious of a landlord's promises anyway. At best, a change in management will mean some badly needed improvements, with affordable rents to encourage the musicians to stay. At worst, gentrification will make good money for the landlord, and the musicians, traditionally a migrant lot, will scatter to new homes. Cecile Savage says they won't be the first victims of the yuppifying of Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood.
Hyde Park used to be a highly artistic neighborhood, which it is not anymore because the people in Hyde Park are very conservative and they want to keep the neighborhood with people who have money. Artists bring a totally different kind of vibes. Usually they don't have a lot of money, but they have advanced ideas. They don't usually live like other people. And when they are black, and if even white, actually, I think the great artists have always been some kind of revolutionary in their minds. So people don't want that in their neighborhood. So in Hyde Park, there used to be a lot of clubs in Hyde Park. There used to be the Beehive, Charlie Parker would come play here. Now they have no clubs, strangely enough. You can go hang out nowhere in Hyde Park.
For her part, Savage plans to rent on the city's north side, which in recent years has become home to an increasing number of new blues and jazz clubs, a revitalized music scene that seems to be picking up where the south side blues tradition left off. I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Few styles have had as much impact on the Latin American music scene as the Nueva Canción or New Song movement. Since its origins in the 60s, it has evolved from being a rather raw and direct protest music to a sophisticated and rich international music form. Puerto Rican composer and singer Roy Brown, one of the most famous Latin new song performers, has just released an album he recorded in Cuba. Elizabeth Perez Luna reports. 3, 2.
I would say the perfect album is an album that is a commentary on life in general, and it will include love and it will include politics.
Roy Brown's new album, Árboles, Trees, fits his description, and it's the result of his collaboration with Cuban singer and composer Silvio Rodriguez, one of the creators of the new Latin American song style.
A song has many purposes. First of all, it's entertaining. It satisfies your brain, a necessity that we have in our minds to do a tune, to reproduce a tune, to soar with a tune. It's a very emotional thing. But also, words are put together in such a way that creates a feeling of well-being, of control, of understanding things. And you, just to say those words, and it creates such an incredible pleasure that it's one of the most important art forms that we have.
20 years ago, the Nueva Canción developed in Chile, Argentina, Cuba, and Puerto Rico out of a need for young musicians to express their political concerns within the context of Latin America's reality. Since then, it has continued to evolve in many directions, often losing some of the sense of urgency that the times demanded, but always retaining its commitment to content. Esta noche tuve que salir a correr, sentir el viento y sudar, cual fuma la roca. Roy Brown started singing in Puerto Rico in the early 60s. His songs spoke of rebellion, injustice, and the need to change society. But even then, he used his poetry and that of other Puerto Rican poets to express the complexities of modern times.
You can't say that all art reflects or comments on society. Some painting is just a commentary on the potential of color. And some songs are just a commentary on the potential of sound.
Le brota en llamaradas por los dedos.
Brown moved to New York in 1976 and has been performing throughout the United States and Latin America for more than 15 years, mostly in concerts that are dedicated to solidarity movements and political action.
Well, at the beginning, we were just barricade singers, and people came because of the political content. So let's say if I would do one song that was very political, great, that's where they clap. But if I do a song about the relationship between a man and a woman, about love, about the love of nature, they would say, oh, you know, what a boring concert. Well, because all they wanted was, hey, 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 hey. And then they only wanted to pay $2 for that, you know. And then they would go to this other concert where they had received this big sound of music with no content at all, and they would pay $20 for that, and they'd have a blast, you know? So we're changing people's tastes for music and for art.
Desde las ondas del mar, que son besos a su orilla, una mujer de Aguadilla vino a New York a cantar. Pero no solo a llorar, un largo llanto y morir, de ese llanto yo nací.
In Árboles, his 10th album, Roy Brown, Silvio Rodriguez, and the group Afro Cuba combine Latin American tunes, jazz, pop, and Caribbean rhythms. The album, recorded in Cuba and manufactured in New York, works within the new style of the Nueva Canción, where exploring music as a language seems to be as important as the content of the songs. And the songs speak of love, hardship, injustice, fun, friendship, and just plain living. This is Elizabeth Perez Luna.